I am Nuno van Tilburg for BizNews. South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa announced his new cabinet, sparking interest in how the African National Congress, or the ANC, will navigate power-sharing dynamics after losing its parliamentary majority in the May 29 elections. And joining us to discuss the cabinet's challenges and political risks is Langalishe Malamela, the head of country risk for sub-Saharan Africa at S&P Global Risk. Welcome to BizNews again, Langa.
Thank you very much, Linda. It's good to be here.
So what are your thoughts on the composition of the new government of national unity?
Gee, well, it took long enough. I think... You know, it was obviously a very difficult process. I remember when we were first talking about when, you know, everything would happen, a lot of clients concerned about the timing of everything. Usually, well, let me say in past elections, following the inauguration, it's been a matter of sort of 4 days to a week or so, and then you have a cabinet announcement. But obviously, this was no ordinary outcome in terms of South Africa's recent history, where elections are concerned, and hence it's taken the better part of 2 weeks to come up with a cabinet announcement after the inauguration, and it was quite clear that there was quite a bit of sort of brinkmanship and maybe even animosity between the main protagonists, the Democratic Alliance and the African National Congress, in reaching this point where a cabinet could be announced. But I think in many ways, this is the outcome that once the election result was clear, that probably Cyril Ramaphosa would have wanted. And he sort of maneuvered and managed all sorts of political chicanery to get to the outcome that probably suits him best from a policy point of view.
Well, there are a couple of surprises in that cabinet. Let's just look at some of them. John Steenhuisen is in, the DA leader, Minister of Agriculture. Angie Motshekga, previously in charge of education, now the defense minister. So how do you interpret some of these surprising moves?
I think, you know, when we previously discussed what was likely to happen in this government of national unity, this grand coalition, what shape it might take, there was early thinking that the executive would virtually entirely be left up to the African National Congress, with the Democratic Alliance then sort of seeking support in taking control of the legislature. You would have this strengthened and galvanized oversight function within the legislature, with speaker positions and heads of committee positions going to the DA, and allowing the ANC to really sort of dominate the executive and run its own programs. And so that's not materialized. And now you've got, you know, these appointments, some of which you've mentioned, which do come as somewhat of a surprise. I think there was a lot of feeling that you know, the DA and John Steenhuisen were pushing for a deputy presidency type role and that kind of thing, which, you know, I'm not entirely sure about. I think you know, deputy president to South Africa, certainly in the sort of post-Thabo Mbeki era, is somewhat of a ceremonial position with you know, a lot of real discretion as to the powers that it has being left up to the president. The real meaty stuff is in some of these senior ministerial posts, of which agriculture is one. And then I think it's quite interesting that you've got... Well, on one hand, you had Ramaphosa wanting to shrink cabinet. I mean, that's part of sort of the broad reform agenda, isn't it? To bring down sort of state spending and you know, but that's not been possible because you've had, by last count, I think 11 parties wanting to be part of the executive, and not all of them, it turns out, actually managed to get a post with a ministerial or a deputy ministerial post. But what's happened is that some departments have been unbundled, if you like. We know now that electricity and energy have been combined into a department, and mineral resources is another department, which will remain under former minerals and energy. and ANC chairperson Gwede Mantashe. And then electricity and energy will go to Khosiyetso Ramakgopa, who's really done a commendable job as electricity minister since that post was created in January 2023. Agriculture is an interesting one because it used to be agriculture, land reform, rural development and land reform, to put it correctly. And the land reform and rural development aspect has been separated from the agriculture aspect. And you've got the leader of the Pan-Africanist Congress as head of the Rural Development and Land Reform Department. And you've got the Democratic Alliance leader, John Steenhuisen, as leader of the Agriculture Department. Now, those two people are going to have to find ways to work together, yet, you know, they come from parties. When it comes to issues of agrarian reform, could not be more sort of ideologically sort of far apart. And so that's an interesting one, and it probably speaks to a wider sort of dilemma in terms of what we are looking for in understanding how this government of national unity is going to work. You know, it seems now that the political theatrics are over. It's time for the mechanics and delivery in terms of the key policy areas that really have an impact on South Africans' lives. You know, in many cases, we are thinking that, you know, it's going to take some time for things to really get going. That is just one example, you know, within the broader sort of agriculture and land reform industry and narrative and broad agenda, post-democratic agenda of agrarian reform in South Africa, land reform, of how we to overcome ideological challenges and deliver on the more practical side.
Well, what investors are looking for is stability. So how do you anticipate the coalition government would manage policy decisions and governance, given that they're so diverse? You know, how stable is this government of national unity going to be?
I think that there are areas where the DA and the ANC, who again are the main players, are going to find it relatively easy to find each other and to cooperate and to work together. And I think, as I said, you know, this is an outcome that probably plays into Ramaphosa's hands from a policy point of view, generally speaking. Because Ramaphosa came in 2018 on a reform ticket on an institution building, business friendly, investment attracting, agenda. And to some extent, that faced a significant amount of internal resistance within the ANC. And so now that, you know, the ANC has suffered with quite a significant blow, I mean, it lost 17 percentage points in terms of support between 2019, which was Ramaphosa's first election as president, and 2024. And so that resistance is now external, sort of outside pushing in. Those that left, you know, like former President Jacob Zuma, obviously, who formed his own party, probably have residual support even remaining now today within the ANC. And still command some sympathy within there. So he's got all of that to navigate, does Ramaphosa, but I think that on the main issues, he is really going to get a lot of support. What we've seen towards the end of the last administration is, you know, an increasing tendency, desire to partner with the private sector in certain key areas where government is sort of aware of its shortcomings, and as I'm talking here about the functioning of key state-owned enterprises, for example, where the parts of the Durban port to Terminal 2 down in Durban, is put out to tender in terms of operation and maintenance. We now have a standalone entity in terms of Eskom and its transmission capacity, where there is a wider remit in terms of where that transmission company can source power from. et cetera. And you know, there's a lot of cynicism about why there hasn't been load shedding in South Africa for 3 or 4 months in and around the election. But, you know, to be sort of fair, you know, we all expected for the vote counting itself to take place in the dark because we thought the lights would go out immediately once the final vote was cast. But here we are a month plus after the election, and, you know, there's been no load shedding still. There is stability within the system, it seems, and there is the metrics are all pointing in the right direction in terms of the electricity availability factor and even to some extent going forward. So there are positive signs, there's green shoots, and I think that in those broad areas, you're probably going to find the DA and ANC finding it easier to work together. And like I say, you know, with Transnet, getting the ports to function well, to function better, getting the right maintenance done and done expeditiously so that, you know, mining exports, for example, which have suffered, I think it's something at, you know, around 11% in 2023, can all those kinds of sort of things can start to improve and sort of look at an upward trajectory again.
Well, can we look at the parties that find themselves outside the government of national unity, the economic freedom fighters? Were they well known in parliament and what they get up to there? But specifically, Jacob Zuma's MK party, who, well, is now in parliament and is not ruling in KwaZulu-Natal because of a coalition there. What kind of political risk is there related to the MK party?
I think that in terms of the economic freedom fighters, the sort of the reputation they've got in terms of how they participate in parliament, I think perhaps those days are gone. The economic freedom fighters suffered a difficult election. The birth of Nkonto Mzizo, which is Jacob Zuma's party you mentioned, which I'll speak about in a minute, was devastating for the African National Congress, but it was also devastating for the economic freedom fighters.
Wow.
The economic freedom fighters, through what they've said, you know, listening to them after the election and just looking at their statements, one gets a sense of a change in sort of tack and how they intend to go about things. I don't see them being that disruptive, young, sort of rambunctious force in parliament anymore. I think they're going to try to be constructive. I think they're going to try to be far more strategic, and certainly will look for every opportunity to work with the new MK party and any other radical parties that are there within parliament. The risk really with the formation of MK, when you look at it vis-a-vis the formation of the Government of National Unity, the Government of National Unity functions at the national level, the provincial level, and the local government level. So the horse trading, the distribution of power and positions that has been unfolding over the past few weeks impacts all those areas. The Government of National Unity partners are in government in KwaZulu-Natal, as much as they are in government at the national level. However, in KwaZulu-Natal, their majority is one seat, right? They have 41 seats out of 80, and then you've got something like 38 seats with Jacob Zuma's party. And I'm speaking under correction, but it is a very thin margin in KwaZulu-Natal, where by far the party with the most votes, the single party with the most votes, is Jacob Zuma's party. That means that disruptions that Zuma is able to cause at the provincial level can have national implications, because they can disrupt the balance of power at the national level, where the IFP leader, for example, is now the Minister of Cooperative Governance. So what machinations are then used to disrupt the local premier in KwaZulu-Natal, who's an IFP secretary general? And this is part, again, sort of the distribution of power and the haggling and so on that's gone on. What disruptions happen locally in KZN, where that majority is so thin,
can have instability repercussions at a national level. And the form that that takes quite maybe is not so clear yet. But those are the kinds of things we're looking for to see, you know, the extent to which the cement can really dry around this agreement and proper governance can take place. Hopefully with a little sort of social disruption. I think that the accountability that comes with what's come out of this election, I think, is welcome, because South Africa is historically, you know, within government, the accountability has been low, high levels of corruption at all levels of government. So the checks and balances which are built into the system and which are intended to sort of be emboldened when you have an outcome like this in a power-sharing agreement are welcome. But it'll take some time for the dust to settle, we think, and for the actual mechanics of governance, day-to-day governance, and actually getting the economy back on a solid track to take hold.
Well, if you look at Senzo Mkhwanazi, the confidant of President Ramaphosa, who has the police portfolio, is that move indicative of efforts to strengthen the police or the influence over the police, particularly in light of the violence we had in July 2021, where the police appeared not to have acted soon enough? So should we read anything into that?
Well, it may be early days yet. You've got an outgoing police minister, Sibongiseni Cele, who's from KwaZulu-Natal. He's a KwaZulu-Natal stalwart of the ANC. You've got an incoming minister of police who is from KwaZulu-Natal, who's a stalwart of the ANC, is a former premier of the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal. Strong figure, commands a lot of support and knows KwaZulu-Natal well. There's no coincidence that you've had two consecutive KwaZulu-Natal based ministers of police at the national level. You refer to July 2021. Obviously, you know, that is an occasion where the former president Jacob Zuma is arrested. He's sent to prison on a Wednesday, and by Friday, things fall apart. There's significant looting, rioting right through that weekend, and it goes on for the better part of 10 days. Very poor response by the police, et cetera, et cetera. Since then, there's a lot of important moves that we think are effectual in terms of, understanding what went wrong, why the police response was so poor, et cetera, et cetera. And some of the things are coincidental. You know, there was no national security advisor at the time while he was on sick leave. There's a national security advisor now to Cyril Ramaphosa. There's a very experienced a person in form of Sydney Mufamadi, who himself is a former minister of police under the Mandela administration. So a seasoned sort of ANC sort of securecrat, but strong administrator and institution builder, Sydney Mufamadi is. He's working in the presidency now, and I, as far as I know, will continue in that role. But also the fact that the State Security Agency has, since after July 2021, been reporting directly into the president. So the Department of what was the Department of Intelligence or the Department of State Security later, its key sort of unit and functioning capabilities have now been brought straight into the presidency. Not everybody was entirely happy about that in terms of civil society, the sort of concentration of power in the presidency of such a crucial function. But what it did do was depoliticize intelligence and give, you know, those people working in the presidency in terms of responding to such events much greater power. That's all to say that the likes of the events that we saw in July 2021 are very unlikely to occur again. But that doesn't mean that sort of, with a Zuma functioning down in KwaZulu-Natal, that certain smaller acts, targeted acts of sabotage intended to cause disruption, intended to send a message, put strangleholds on the economy, shutting down main arteries, disrupting port activity, even communications capabilities, are not are not going to happen, because we think that that type of thing, smaller but more impactful events like that, are likely as the MK, which is new but outside the outside sort of the tent, as it were, seeks to express itself.
Longo Malamela, thank you so much for speaking to us.
My pleasure.